October 8th, 1871, that was the date for the devastating fire that burned the city of Peshtigo to the ground. And despite the massive tragedy, almost overshadowed by the Chicago fire, which occurred on the same night, my guest takes us back in time and describes what exactly led to the Great Peshtigo Fire and what lessons we took away from it. He's got a lot of really good information in this book, and it's aimed at a younger audience, although I have to tell you, I enjoyed reading it myself. I've read some things about the book, about the Peshtigo Fire, certainly over the years, but I found myself really interested in he manages to establish a certain amount of tension in the book that is very interesting. I know it's certainly appealed to me. I know it's going to appeal to young readers and old readers alike. My guest is Scott Nicholbein. He writes about Wisconsin history, is the author of 40 books, and his latest is The Great Peshtigo Fire, Stories and Science from America's Deadliest Fire Storm. And that's the other thing I really liked about your book, by the way, the science part of it. I'm a professor in the Department of Life Sciences Communication at the UW, and so a chance to have some kind of adventure and science together?
Well, I think that one of the things that the Wisconsin Historical Society Press was interested in was having a book that kind of took a new take on the Peshtigo Fire for readers at about the fourth grade level. And so what I tried to do was to bring in not only some of the obvious aspects of history, but also some of these scientific ideas regarding fire and weather patterns and those types of things, so that kids could come away from reading about the Peshtigo Fire with really a more thorough knowledge, not just of how it happened, but what a remarkable event it was.
Yeah.
And really, I think one of the reasons so many adults enjoy it is that, you know, the Peshtigo Fire is really a hugely misunderstood event. Its importance in American history is really understood only by people who study fire.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that even takes, you know, adults like me who were raised in Wisconsin and taught about the Peshtigo Fire themselves in fourth grade, mm-hmm. where, you know, there's a lot of surprises in this book.
Yeah, that's for sure. Cynthia Woodland, was, one of our producers, was saying, man, I wish I'd had something like this when I was in fourth grade. My fourth grade version of the Peshtigo Fire was not very much.
Right. Well, basically, we were all taught that it was a really big, bad forest fire. And that, you know, as luck would have it, it was on the same night as the Chicago fire, and that's why nobody heard about it.
We're going to take some – I want to break in for just a minute because I wanted to mention that President Obama is – this is a totally different subject here, but President Obama is making a statement regarding the situation in Iraq and the possible introduction of U.S. ground forces there. So if you're interested in hearing NPR's coverage of the president's statements – you can go, it's available as a live stream at WPR.org. So just go to WPR.org if you want to listen to what the president has to say. And if not, if you'd rather hear about the Great Peshtigo Fire and kind of the science around it in this book by Scott Nicholbein, I hope you'll just stay with us here on the Ideas Network. And I'm sorry I broke in on you there.
Not a problem.
Scott. But.
So, you know, the idea that this was just a big forest fire is was incorrect. It was a firestorm. And in fact, one of the first recorded firestorms in history. A firestorm being a fire that burns so intensely and so quickly that it actually creates its own weather system, a weather system that is like a whirlwind and that brings in oxygen so that the fire burns at heats that are so tremendously high that you start to see things like sand melting into glass, for instance, and tree roots burning below the surface of the soil. The other thing was that it was just not a coincidence that the Peshtigo Fire and the Great Chicago Fire occurred on the same evening. In fact, those two fires were part of a huge network of fires that swept from Wisconsin, jumped Lake Michigan, and went all the way across the state of Michigan to the Thumb area, and then the next day into Ontario. So by looking at all these fires as distinct events, we miss the fact that it was a one-night event that was one of the greatest natural cataclysms in the history of the country.
It was absolutely amazing. And we had many eyewitnesses. There, a lot of people survived it, although what was the total death total? Over 1,000 people, wasn't it?
Well, they don't know for sure. The high estimates are around 2,500.
Wow.
Within Peshtigo itself, they recovered something like 700 bodies.
Boy. Some eyewitnesses said they saw balls of fire.
Correct.
Falling from the sky.
Right. And this led, yes, many eyewitnesses said that they saw these huge fireballs that landed with a great blast and fire starting immediately in those areas. And that led some researchers to speculate for many decades thereafter that the fire was caused by meteors. That was one theory that they thought that would explain the fireballs, but also why so many of these fires were starting over such a large range at the same time. We found out, of course, that it could not, in fact, have possibly have been meteors. But what it was actually something even stranger, which was that these burning tree trunks were being lifted by the massive updraft that was created by this firestorm and then flung sometimes more than a mile downrange. So people who were not yet near the fire suddenly saw this enormous piece of flaming debris seemingly falling from the sky. So this is just another example of the unthinkable forces that were unleashed by this phenomenon.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. If you have a question or comment about the fire, what questions do you have about the Peshtigo Fire? What resonates with you about the story of that tragedy? What lessons could we take away from it? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and you can post your questions or your comments right there. There were so many interesting things about the science of it, and the fact that a lot of the fires were there were a lot of fires going on ahead of the actual big fire.
That's correct, and that's another thing that's sometimes overlooked when we teach about Peshtigo nowadays, is that there were fires going on, forest fires, fires that were out of control fires that had been going on for more than a week prior to the evening of the Peshtigo Fire. In fact, earlier that week, one of the large piles of sawdust near the Woodworks factory in Peshtigo, which was the largest of its kind in the world, caught fire and required volunteers from all parts of town to fight it. So, the weeks leading up to the Peshtigo Fire, there was so much smoke in the air in towns like Peshtigo and Marinette that schools were closed because it was too dark at midday for the kids to read indoors. Yeah. So this was something that was not an isolated event in terms of a fire. it was something that came to a head on the evening of October 10th in the form of the firestorm.
Yeah, actually, I think if had it been something that happened just that night or that day, and for the first time, people probably would have been a little more careful, and more people probably might have been saved. But this was sort of insidious in a way, in that it happened over a kind of a long period of time, and some people didn't even think that, you know, oh, what the heck, it's just another day. And
well, that's part of it. I mean, part of it was that these folks had survived and had fought many smaller fires.
Yeah.
And there was sort of this frontier bravado at the time. Like, we came out here, we're going to tough it out, a little smoke's not going to scare us, that sort of thing. Although many people were frightened.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the evenings, the days up leading up to October 8th, people were burying their valuables and things like that. So it's not as if there wasn't a sense of dread and foreboding. But there was this sort of idea that we're going to just kind of give it the old Yankee courageousness here in situations where you or I, Larry, might have, you know, packed up the car and gotten out.
Get the heck out of here.
Yeah.
Carolyn Superior, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. You'll have to do a little research if you're interested in this. But there was a mineral exploration about the time of the Chicago and Peshtigo fire, and a learned man who was looking for ore and so forth on the Gogebic Iron Range.
Yep.
Near Hurley and Ironwood, and I hope I'm pronouncing his last name right, Pompanelli.
Okay.
His book was published in a limited manner, and I have not seen it, but I have been told by someone, a historian, that he was up in Ironwood, Michigan, on top of the Newport Hill, which is a very high place, and he was looking to the southeast. He thought he was seeing the Chicago fire, but it was later learned that he was seeing the Peshtigo fire. And I was told as a crow flies how far it was, you know, I don't know if it was 160 miles as a crow flies.
Wow. And you know what? I hope you can hang on, Carol. We need to take a quick look at the news and weather. We'll be back, though, to talk more with Scott Nicolbein about the Great Peshtigo Fire. The Great Peshtigo Fire killed more people than the Chicago Fire, which happened the very same night. Although it was a devastation to the city of Peshtigo and the surrounding areas, a lot of lessons about fire prevention and management came out of that tragedy, and we're learning about some of them today as we visit with our guest, Scott Nicolbein. Scott's the author of The Great Peshtigo Fire, Stories and Science from America's Deadliest Firestorm. It's a book aimed at young readers, but I have to tell you that I found it very interesting and entertaining. And I've got a 10-year-old daughter at home who's, I know, going to enjoy it. She loves to read, and she's really going to enjoy it. The Carol from Superior mentioned the someone sitting up on a high hill, overlooking the fire, and thought it was the Chicago fire.
Yes, and I had not heard of that particular report, but I don't find it incredible at all that somebody several hundred, almost 200 miles away, could have seen the glow from this fire on top of a hill, because, you know, this firestorm had this enormous updraft. That's one of the aspects of a firestorm. The heat causes this enormous rush of air upwards, which brings cool air inward at such a high speed that the center of the flame, center of the fire, burns at abnormal temperatures, almost like you had a bellows.
Mm.
So Father Peter Pernin, one of our best contemporary sources of information on the fire, spent that night in the Peshtigo River. And he reported that when he looked up straight up overhead, all he could see in the sky for as far as he could see was flames. So it's not a, wouldn't be unusual that somebody from a high vantage point quite a distance away would have been able to see that fire.
Mm. David in Sturgeon Bay has a question or comment. Hi, David. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Larry, I know that you come up to Door County. I wondered if you have ever stopped at a little wayside called Tornado Park in Door County. That is a site of a small village that was here in Southern Door and was destroyed on the day of October 8th. Wondered if you knew about that.
I did not. Where is it located?
Well, it's on Highway 57, south of Sturgeon Bay. And there's a little park there called Tornado Park. It was a village of about 77 people. 60 of the people attempted to flee the village to get their way to the bay and were burned to death. And the only survivors of Williamsonville were the ones who made their way down into a well.
Oh, interesting.
I believe that park has a marker in it that makes a reference to a tornado fire, does it not?
Yes, it's called Tornado Park.
Yeah,
and that was one of the fire managed to actually cross the Bay of Green Bay at its southernmost part and start yet again with the same sort of intensity. I believe that's around Dykesville or Brussels, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just by Dykesville. So, okay. Larry, when you come up here again, stop and visit.
I will. I will actually do that. I'll be actually coming up that way in a while. I will do that. Thank you very much, David. Appreciate it. We have more callers. Jim in Wanakee, it's your turn. Hi, Jim. Thank you for calling.
Well, thanks for the program. I just want to say that I visited that museum in Peshtigo, and that was one of the most moving experiences of my life. I remember what it felt like during 9/11, and going through that museum, reading the stories, the human stories, and I just recently took an architectural tour of Chicago, and they talked about the Chicago fire. But I can tell you that the loss of human life was just, there was just no comparison. I mean, Chicago fire was sad, but I remember a story from that museum where, you know, went through the graveyard, and that was an incredible experience. But where this young man, his he was trying to save his younger brother and sister, and he had to escape from the fire going into the, I think it was the Peshtigo River. And so the firestorm just swept across the river, and he had to duck under, you know, when these storms of fire came across. And so I believe he survived, but he actually, and he didn't mean to do this, but just save his brother and younger, I think one of them was an infant, you know, they drowned. Right. And, you know, it's just human stories like that, that if you go to that museum, and especially if you walk to that graveyard and you see, you just pick up a mood there that's, it's just unbelievable. And if you can get out of there without shedding a tear, I don't think you're human.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and Scott, I bet you've been there.
Oh, yes, absolutely. They were very helpful to us in compiling the information for the book. It is a moving experience. I think that, you know, most of the people who survived in the town of Peshtigo did do so by getting into the river. But as the last caller made clear, that was no guarantee of survival. The air above the river was so hot that if you put your head up to get air, if it was up for more than a few seconds, your hair would start to burn. So you've got so basically you had people bobbing up and down in the water all night. Then you not only had all the survivors in Peshtigo in that area, but you had all the horses and cows and livestock that had managed to make it down there. So it's just this a scene of a thrashing and chaos. Many people who survived to get into the river didn't survive that.
That's amazing. And I wanted to, you brought up another point. An earlier caller mentioned some people surviving by going in a well. This was a different fire, but you report.
That wasn't a very useful strategy for most of the people inland from the Peshtigo River. The problem was that, again, this updraft caused by this firestorm was capable of sucking all of the oxygen out of any enclosed space. So many of these people who tried to escape down wells died of suffocation, and many of the bodies that could have been recovered because the cause of death was suffocation rather than being incinerated.
Marcus in Green Bay, thank you so much for calling. Hi.
Marcus?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. I was kind of thinking that the Peshtigo fire area might be kind of like an archaeology site. I was up there about 10 years ago, and I was in the woods and poking around, and if I'm not mistaken, there's the tree stumps from the fire are still there, like these mounds, or these huge mounds. And then I had my walking stick, and I'm poking along, and I started finding these knots of the tree trunk, the branches that go inside the tree trunk. And I have a couple dozen of these knots. They're real beautiful pieces of wood, and they didn't burn because they're loaded with so much resin, they were preserved or whatever. And I just wondered if the guest ever heard of anything like this. It's almost like they're little gems, of a time gone by, the last remaining something or other, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I had not heard of those. Too long ago, there was some archaeological digging done in Peshtigo proper in the cellar of one of the few buildings from old Peshtigo that had been built in stone. And this is one of the things you can see at the museum. They found a pocket Bible that somebody had been reading, obviously on the night of the fire. It was still open, and the heat of the fire above actually not only carbonized the pages, but actually hardened them. So this Bible that looks quite frail is in fact as hard as a rock, but you can actually still read some of the printing in sort of black on black on these open pages. So that was one of the last real artifacts recovered from that fire.
Mm, interesting. Thanks, Marcus, very much for calling. I appreciate your call. And I believe you have a photograph of that Bible in your book.
Yep, there's a nice little display that they have of that and a few other sort of melted artifacts that were found in that cellar.
I really like, one of the things I liked a lot was the your use of, you have photos, you have some many paintings, mm-hmm. and some drawings as well that really, I think, add a lot.
Well, one of the things, when you're going to write for younger readers, you need illustrations. I mean, not just to keep them interested, but particularly when you're talking about things like the weather patterns that led up to the Peshtigo fire and the science of firestorms and those types of things, it's always great to have illustrations. So we did our homework and
tried to get
not just old black and white images from the time, but also color images that are illustrative of some of the processes and things that we're talking about.
Hmm. Carol in Superior. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I just wanted to add, I was cut off earlier.
Oh.
But in 1871, a mineral explorer, quite famous, Raphael Pumpinelli,
mm-hmm.
I do believe I've got that name right, wrote a diary about his explorations on the Iron Range in the Hurley, Wisconsin area, and right across the West Branch of the Montreal is Ironwood, Michigan. That's the Gogebic Range. And Pompanelli, the day of the fire, it's written in his journal. I didn't read it. I was told it by someone reputable. Was up in Newport location in Jessaville, Michigan, right out of Ironwood, a very, very high point. And he could look to the southeast and see this smoke. I don't know if he saw a fireball, too, but it was columns of smoke. But and he thought it was Chicago fire, but right. Later found out it was a Peshtigo fire. And I'm glad for your answer that you gave, you know, that it was possible to see a fire like that from a couple, or smoke from a couple hundred miles away. But I just wanted to give you the information about Raphael Pompanelli's diaries.
Yeah.
You may want to look up one of his diaries and see what he has to say about it. And would you repeat your name after and the title of the book?
Sure, absolutely. We can do that right now. As a matter of fact, our author is Scott Nickelbein. So it's Nickelbine. So Nickelbein. And actually, if you go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, you're going to find it. A reference to it there. The title of the book is The Great Peshtigo Fire, Stories and Science from America's Deadliest Firestorm. And it's a book from the State Historical Society Press. So you can also find it by just going to their website as well. But we've got a link to it right on my Facebook page. So I hope you'll take a look at it. Carolyn, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Bill and Hurley a chance to join in. Bill, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking that call. Myself?
Oh, you're breaking up. We lost you.
The Badger paper plant. You there?
Yeah. You were breaking up for a minute, so go ahead. Let's see if we can get you now.
Oh, yes. My father, Bill Sr., and my uncle Pete, we were involved in the removal, demolition of the Badger paper plant on the river. And we took a day just to tour the museum.
Oh, I am very sorry. You're breaking up, Bill, and I can't keep you on because we can't hear you. That's very unfortunate. I think everybody who I've talked to who has visited that museum has been quite moved by it.
They've done quite a bit of work to pull together sort of the surviving artifacts from Peshtigo. And there aren't many, as you can imagine. They've also gathered quite a few documents, letters from survivors, letters that people had written to their kinfolk that are quite moving and that were useful to us in terms of writing some of the narratives. One of their newest acquisitions is a color portrait of Father Peter Pernin, who was the priest in the Catholic Church there in Peshtigo, and whose first-person narrative was one of the first books about the Peshtigo fire, and the most important in the fact that he was an eyewitness and wrote such an extended narrative of it. But the world didn't really know what he looked like. We had a fairly crude woodcut of him, and that's what appeared in most of the editions of his book. And then a couple, I believe it was in Colorado, purchased an old painting, oil painting, because they liked the frame at an auction. And they removed the painting from it, and underneath it, they found this portrait of a priest. And they did some research, found it was Peter Pernin, and this couple just showed up apparently one day at the fire museum and turned this portrait over. So we now have a color portrait of this man who was so incredibly important in our understanding of this event.
Wow, wow. Dropped right into the lap.
Absolutely.
Oh, man. Tom in Brussels. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I did some research on the fire over here in Door County, and the information I have, most of the things I read, said that the fire didn't actually jump the bay, but it was part of the weather pattern and the fires that already existed in the area, that the dry wind just came up and blew up the fires that already existed. And I wonder if your guest could talk about that.
There is quite a bit of controversy as to what the actual what gave that fire in the Brussels Dykesville region its start. There are some researchers who simply don't believe that burning materials could have crossed that distance. However, you also do have to explain how a fire of that intensity could get started that quickly. I mean, in order to get a fire whirl, you have to have a fire that's burning very hot and burning very quickly. They don't just start spontaneously. So there are people who feel that it was a question of hot material being lofted by the firestorm before it actually reached Peshtigo. Recall that it actually started a ways south of Peshtigo, and its track was northeast, going through Peshtigo and ending out skirting the west side of Marinette. So there's some thought that that actually materials uplifted could have crossed that distance. And however, you are absolutely correct that there were other fires that evening that could not possibly have been started by materials from Peshtigo. So whether it was that or one of the other types of situations that caused all those fires on those evenings or on that evening, we don't know.
Interesting.
Did you investigate how the railroads, back then there was coal burning trains, and they had huge, the railroad had buy large tracts of land just so that the cinders that would start a fire wouldn't burn private property. Did you look into that at all?
Yes. In fact, that's described in detail in the book. You know, it's interesting that I'm often asked when I speak publicly about the Peshtigo fire, well, what was the cause of the Peshtigo fire? I think people are looking for a Mrs. O'Leary's cow for the Peshtigo fire. And the fact of the matter is that fire was being used in the area. I mean, we talk about some of the natural fires that were occurring. But let's not forget, you mentioned that the trains were sending out cinders. Also, they were extending the trains north and northeast through Wisconsin in order to clear the paths for those. They often used slash and burn to clear that land. Farmers were using slash and burn. The logging operations that were so active in the area were creating great piles of slash, from branches and undergrowth and that sort of thing that were cut in the process of their operations. They were making mountains of this stuff and just leaving it to sit. And then you had towns like Peshtigo, which were producing huge amounts of sawdust as part of their operations in making wood products. You had steam irons, you had open fires, you had farmers burning fields to clear them. It's like, what couldn't have been the source of that fire?
Thank you, Tom, for calling. And Scott, thank you so much. This is a great book. I really enjoyed it. I know my 10-year-old daughter is going to enjoy reading it as well. Scott Nicholbine, author of The Great Peshtigo Fire, Stories and Science from America's Deadliest Firestorm. And it's published by Wisconsin Historical Society Press. Go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can get a link there and link right to it. Great to have him along. And thank you so much for listening in. Tomorrow, the Vicars of Vegetables join us to talk about your garden. Thanks for listening. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.